Getting the form flipped? Everybody will be after them.
Hello and good morning. I'm Bill Richardson at CBC Vancouver, and welcome to episode 6 of this summer-long curatorial project. It's called 10 Times Table.
I chose temperance, and then I got a bunch of friends together. We came here late at night to the CBC in downtown Toronto. I emailed ahead to the producer to tell him to buy, like, you know, basically $300 worth of alcohol or maybe even more.
Today at the table, the young Toronto writer and impresario and animatrice, Sheila Hetty, someone who truly knows how to have a good time.
And then we got steadily drunker, me and four or five friends, and just sort of taped the conversation over a period of about 4 hours. And anyways, they didn't air it.
Well, we'll fix that up this morning. Sheila Hetty will turn 30 this coming Christmas Day. She was just 24, I think, when she published her first book, which is a strange and beguiling and highly original collection of fables called The Middle Stories. This past fall, she released a slim and quite dense and altogether fascinating novel called Tickner, T-I-C-K-N-O-R. It's not right to say that it's based on, but it takes its cue from or inspiration from the lives of two 19th century Bostonian gentlemen. Had you ever heard of Mr. Tickner before you heard of Mr. Tickner?
No. No, and I really haven't heard of him since either. Mm. I just came across this book that George Tickner had written in sort of fortuitously in a cafe while my friend was late. And they had this bookshelf, and I just sort of stumbled upon it. It was the oldest book on the bookshelf, mm-hmm. and it said Tickner on the side, and I sort of pulled it off the shelf and just opened it and liked it, well, thought it was bizarre and stole it. And I thought, like, I've got to justify this stealing of this book somehow, so that's how it became the basis of the novel.
I'm a huge fan, I have to say, of the cafe or the library bar. You know what I mean? There is stuff on there, and you know what happens? They buy the stuff by the foot from some dealer who sells it that way. They have no idea what's there. Nobody ever looks at it. But every now and then, something will leap off the shelves that will lead to something else.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, but, you know, leap off the shelves and, like, never leap back. Like, it was pretty it was pretty empty by the time I got to it.
So the book is called The Life of William Hickling Prescott, and he was?
He was a historian and wrote some very popular books about Spain and Mexico, and he was friends with George Tickner, best friends. And after he died, I guess Tickner felt compelled to write a very passionate biography of his friend, and it's filled with letters and that all of Prescott's friends wrote to him, and, you know, it's very devoted and very admiring. And
Tickner himself was, in some ways, I think, almost the founder of the study in North America of Spanish literature, right?
I guess so, yeah, that's what I hear.
And Prescott kind of followed in his footsteps in that way?
To be frank, I didn't really read the whole biography. I just read what I needed, and then I didn't really study either of them that much. I kind of tried to stay away to feel free to fictionalize, because I just really wasn't that interested in either of the men. I just liked the way that Tickner wrote and kind of wanted to imitate him and so on, you know. But
you know, it's pretty extraordinary because, truly, had you pulled another book off the shelf, it seems unlikely to me that it would have had this kind of effect. I mean, there must have been something in that moment and something in that style that settled on you so tellingly.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I opened it up and I was... He has sort of a circular way of writing and coming back to things that's almost a little obsessive, but it's also very sort of ornate and kind of baroque. And, I don't know, it just sort of hit me, you know, somebody walks into a room and you kind of feel like you've just sort of fallen in love, and it was that kind of experience, and that's why I had to keep it. But yeah, if I hadn't found the book, I totally wouldn't have written this book, which may have been okay, in some way.
So you didn't immerse yourself too terribly deeply in either gentleman's life, but here and there, biographical details emerged, like, for instance, tell me the story of the errant bun.
Oh yeah, well that was true. Prescott was sort of partially blinded in some way by a bun that was thrown, a bread roll that was thrown in an accident you know, in a food fight, basically, when he was in school, and he got the bun in his eye, and the eye didn't close, and forever after that, he had troubles with seeing, which is just kind of the way things happen.
Yeah, I guess so, especially with mid-19th century incredibly crusty buns.
Yes, and boys.
Boys. not to laugh, but of course, at this distance, and in our age when buns are doughy things, and it's almost impossible to imagine them doing something like damage, it gives a kind of, I don't know, corporal body to the idea of the bun fight that we wouldn't have had before.
I suppose, I mean, do you really think that they were probably crustier then?
Oh, I'm sure they were. I'm sure that they were crustier, and I'm sure the boys were crustier as well,
actually. Yeah, the whole culture.
Do you think that had you come across this snippet of information about Tichner on a website, that it would have the same impact as it had on you finding this book, this physical object, in this cafe library?
No, not at all, because the whole thing was that I took the book and then I had it beside me on the desk, and it was just sitting there for months and months, and I felt so... And I didn't open it, and I felt kind of intimidated or a little guilty about it or something. And I think I felt like I had to in some way respond to it, just because I had taken it with this kind of feeling like, oh, this will serve me better than it could possibly serve anybody else. So I had to do something about that. Whereas if I had just come across it on the web, you know, obviously I would have just like, I would have just gone, you know, started like surfing porn or something at some point. Like, I completely forgot all about Tichner. And just like, the whole night would have gone.
It's a book about friendship in lots of ways, and I think that you belong to a generation of writers which has struck with people who are working in other disciplines, with painters or with filmmakers.
Yeah, and also painters are kind of interesting, and filmmakers are interesting, and writers, if a bunch of writers end up hanging out together, then, I don't know, it's just kind of lopsided. I like a lot of painters. There's something more natural about them, whereas a lot of writers I know, that it's just too cerebral, and you end up just talking too much and stuff like that, and whereas with painters, they're just a lot of fun.
What's happening in Toronto that's sparking this kind of, I don't want to say a renaissance, because it suggests that at one point it died and then came back. It's always been a busy place. But what's going on there that you find so exciting right now as a woman not quite 30?
Well, I guess what it is that people from a lot of different fields are collaborating with each other. So, like you were saying earlier, it's not just that the writers are talking to other writers, but writers and people in music and visual artists and filmmakers, and everyone's kind of doing things together, just because, I don't even know why. I mean, maybe because the economics have changed, that it's cheaper to do things like film. And I guess there's also something about, well, no, you know, Toronto is, I guess, the place where you go if you're sort of an ambitious person, you want to try to be seen, but like, there's such a low ceiling. Like, even if you do kind of make your name or get some success in Toronto, it's still not that much. Like, it's not like going to New York and then you're in all the American magazines. So, there's no real reward in some ways, but the main reward really is just that you get to know a lot of interesting people, and then what do you do with that? Well, you just make things with them.
Tell me about dance. Are you not dancing these days as well?
With four dancers from the National Ballet of Canada and me, and the director always refers to us as four dancers plus Sheila. I don't know if it's a compliment or a humiliation, but...
Do you have any qualification for doing this? Do you have any dance background?
No, but
ballet is a little girl?
Yeah, ballet is a little girl, and I'm a, you know, my friends think I'm a good dancer, but I worked with this director when I was 15 and until I was around 21, and did it's DNA theater, and it's sort of experimental theater, and so he wanted to work with me again, and I kind of wanted to dance, and so now I'm, yeah, it's pretty nice. I go to rehearsals every day and I just dance.
What's it look like? What do they make you do?
I can do whatever I want. It's the other girls that have the choreography. So they kind of are choreographed on the stage, and I get to sort of dance among them in whatever way I please.
What fun!
Yeah.
So does it change all the time?
Yeah, yeah.
Does the director give you any suggestion, any advice, or are you literally just free to kind of drift?
No, I mean, he did... what note did he give me yesterday? He said that it's good when I'm serious, so I can be serious on stage a little more. I guess I'm just having so much fun, but he likes that too, and mostly the notes are that those kind of things. You know, we try to decide whether I can or cannot touch the dancers. You know, that's an issue that's come up. Things like that. If I do, where I can, hard, things like that.
In other words, it's the kind of protocols and restraints that apply to any workplace.
That's right, that's right.
On CBC Radio 1 and on Sirius Satellite 137, you're listening to 10 Times Table. I'm Bill Richardson. My guest is the Toronto writer, well, polymath really, Sheila Hetty. Tickner, T-I-C-K-N-O-R, is her most recent novel. The object of this exercise is, over the course of 9 weeks, to assemble interesting talkers around this table. The 10th week will bring them all together in a virtual way through editing. My guest next week is Kevin Bozana, the musicologist who is the author of a prize-winning biography of Glenn Gould called Wondrous Strange, and he is preparing a new book about the mysterious pianist
Ervin Nyíregyházi.
Hungarian?
Yeah. Literally, he lived this sort of hand-to-mouth existence for 50 years. He sort of became dissolute. He ended up moving to Los Angeles, lived in flop houses. He married 10 times. He had endless affairs. He was just one of these sexually voracious types. And then in the 70s, he was rediscovered briefly. And for about 2 years, he was the subject of a really big sort of fad. Hobo pianist, yep. You know, brought back from nowhere.
Kevin Bozana will be at the table next week with New Yorker editor David Remnick. And now, returning to Sheila Hetty in Toronto. Your family's Hungarian.
Yes, they are.
Okay, so were you born there or here?
No, I was born in Toronto.
In Toronto, yeah. And when did your parents come over?
My dad in 56, and my mom came over when she was in her 20s, so that was in the early 70s.
So your dad was part of the revolution sweep?
Yes.
Did he talk a lot about that?
No, I mean, mostly, if he did talk about it, it was just from a very personal, you know, perspective, like, coming over, you know, no. My family doesn't really have a great nostalgic streak, I suppose.
And you haven't dug into it? You haven't quizzed them?
There are some good stories, but I think most of them are probably just the way stories are, not exactly. I can't really even know whether the stories that I have about all that in my head are, you know, like the event that actually happened. Do you know what I mean? Like, family stories kind of take on this really strange, unbelievable air.
Well, I have no family stories.
Well, I have two or three.
Tell me one.
Like, I have a feeling that they kind of escaped in the middle of the night, like on Christmas, and were walking through the snow. I mean, I'm not going to do it justice, but I think no one who told it to me has done it justice. And, I mean, well, my grandfather was an artist, and so in order to sort of buy their way or sneak their way onto the train, he painted stamps on people's passports and things like that, and sort of traded his talent for this kind of crossing. I feel like every time I hear the story, I remember it differently.
Tell me about this piece called Temperance.
Oh, yeah, well, it was great. I mean, the CBC asked me to do a piece for them for a series called The Seven Heavenly Virtues, and I chose Temperance. And then I got a bunch of friends together. We came here late at night to the CBC in downtown Toronto, and, you know, I emailed ahead to the producer to tell him to buy, like, you know, basically $300 worth of alcohol or maybe even more. We got steadily drunker, me and four or five friends, and just sort of taped the conversation over a period of about 4 hours. And we would drink upstairs, not in the actual studios. We would drink in, like, the lounge.
Oh, and that's a relief.
Yeah, because we didn't want to, I don't know what, why. We were just observing some form of propriety. And yeah. But it was just like every time we came down the elevator, I would just feel more and more dizzy and more drunk. So I just remember these crazy elevator rides. And then the idea was that you would sort of see what drinking does to people in conversation, and then it was like a 6-minute piece, and then I played it backwards. I edited it so it was backwards from the most drunk to most sober. And the conclusion that I came to was that a little bit of alcohol actually is really nice for conversation and for, you know, joviality, but not too much. And also, like, the sobriety was also not very interesting. But, you know, like, a couple of drinks really actually does the trick that it's supposed to do. But we had problems. Like, a girl walked out because people started talking about the war, mm-hmm. And it got pretty. Anyways, they didn't air it. In short.
Well, you know, we could.
You could?
Well, if you'd like, we could play it.
Yeah, that'd be great.
The time is 1:07 a.m.
Santa,
no,
because
it's important, because the two of you agree, but right you're now. Choosing to disagree. The two of you agree,
so
but you're choosing to disagree.
No, 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 stop it. Like,
to disagree.
What do you give a about? Well, like, are you... You haven't even thought about your death
yes,
yet.
Yes, I have.
The time is 12:16 a.m.
Well, you walked out.
I walked out, and I've opted to leave the segment for this evening because I believe that no one should talk about something so important when they're under the influence of alcohol or drugs of any sort. And I am, and I don't believe that I can have an intelligent opinion at this point, and I don't believe that people's lives should be discussed under such circumstances.
Like the people that are affected by the war, like people as in the people that are talking in the segment?
Either. I think that a nation's radio and television does have an impact on the people listening. And I don't think that people listening should be listening to people who are drunk on air.
Because why?
Talking about political decisions of any sort, especially ones that involve whether or not people live or die. But now I think we're saying things that are based in emotionalism. And probably my reaction is also based in emotionalism, but I have to leave now because I don't have faith in my own emotions on something this important.
Because you're drunk.
Yes.
Anyways, you can turn the tape off.
Thank you. I'm sorry.
I just really want you to know that, like...
I know you didn't.
The time is 11:18 p.m.
Down the hatch.
That's nice.
You
I
have
like,
to have one conversation. I want to talk about the war.
Being drunk feel useful.
Okay. Okay, let's talk about the
okay,
war.
Okay, Mr.
I want to say this.
Talk about the war.
Thank you.
Which
I want to say this.
Do not speak about the war.
No, we have to have a conversation.
I actually support...
A little farther away from...
I actually support what George W. Bush and Donald Rumsfeld and the United States government did in Afghanistan.
Oh, wait.
Did in Afghanistan. Believe it or not, have you read the book Shrubbed about George W. Bush and his how he ascended to the United States presidency? I do not like this man. However... What they did in Afghanistan was entirely right and proper and good for the world.
Oh my God.
Absolutely. And I think analysis of what happened in Afghanistan will reveal
you.
That is true.
What is wrong with you?
And however, I do not...
What is wrong with you?
What is wrong with me?
Do you know how many innocent
civilians
in Afghanistan have been murdered?
Yeah, about 15,000. About 15,000.
I'm sorry, but I have to say now, I don't think it's right to put drunk people on air talking about...
War.
Oh,
it is.
You're kind of right there.
No, I'm.
It is
I'm
because
kind
we're
of,
drunk.
I'm kind
no.
of in agreement with this. This I don't.
So although it's good
no.
to know. Who's
I disagree.
We kind of are.
I think war is real.
Morally, it's just not right.
I don't want.
Do you feel like you're gonna?
I'm saying the exact same thing I would say as I was sober, which is that what they did in Afghanistan was right, and what they want to do in Iraq is wrong.
Fine,
there?
But I withhold comment. From now until we stop recording.
Yeah, I'm doing that as well.
No,
I don't want to participate
been drinking,
in this.
And I don't believe that I can.
But we have no geopolitical import anyway.
Opinion after.
This is going to kill the entire evening if this gets pushed any further. I really think
we should
change tracks here. I'm horrified by something that was just expressed.
Yeah, but if you weren't.
Well, you're horrified by. Hold on. All I'm saying is that girls in Afghanistan can go to school now. Go ahead. Well, say it then.
Now we're in war.
Say what you protest with.
Yeah, this is a bad idea.
The time is 10:08 p.m.
This is CBC Radio.
Hold on, who wants to kill us all?
And in approximately 30 seconds,
like
it will be exactly 1 o'clock.
That's paprika.
No, it's tequila.
Beep, 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 beep.
1 o'clock.
Beep.
Keep it up.
Yes.
The time is 9:31 p.m.
You want to say exactly till 21, 31, 21?
Yeah. Okay, go. Talk about Blind Date. Blind Date.
Okay, well, the thing that interests me about Blind Date, that I like about Blind Date,
it's a great show.
So far as to say, is the fact that to go on Blind Date, you know that the producers are going to have a field day. The producers are going to tear you apart.
Try to burn
and
you.
And yet people still go on Blind Date. So it seems to me that the game, the actual game of Blind Date, is how you go through Blind Date without getting the producers to destroy you. Like, that's the object of the game.
So is this the one with the bubble?
You don't need the producers to destroy you. The whole point of the show is that people happily and naturally will humiliate themselves, which is a more interesting aspect.
No, but with which is what we're all doing now.
But that's,
I think there's vastly more interesting types of humiliation than the kind of surface scratching and the facile stuff that you
see
on the
show. But it's not just about the humiliation, because you actually do get to see people on dates.
The time is 8:01 p.m.
Did you use that?
I'm on it religiously.
How's it working?
I haven't smoked.
But no side effects?
Really intense dreams for the first week.
Oh, that's what I've heard.
And then there were two.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
Because it's like you're smoking all night long.
It could be, depending on what
stimulating.
You're thinking about and stuff. Yeah. So it was too much, so I took it off. I found the right motivation for it, though.
Yeah.
Yeah, boredom. Quit because I'm bored.
Mm-hmm. Something you can do that? You can quit because you're bored?
If you're, like, profoundly bored and you want something really different to happen in your life.
You're tired of the same stimulation over and over again.
Tired of the same old, same old.
Sheila Hetty and some friends, a piece called Temperance that was recorded at the CBC in Toronto a few years ago, and it's available on her website, SheilaHetty.com. I think heard on the CBC for the first time. Do you want to identify those friends? Or can you remember at this point?
Yeah, it was my friend Julia Rosenberg, and Emily Schultz, and Anton Piatigorsky, and Sean K. Robb, and Patrick Roscoe. And I hope I'm not forgetting anybody. I think that might have been it.
Okay. Now, Patrick Roscoe, he's kind of a regular, or has been at Trampoline Hall, which I know you're no longer involved in, or I don't think you are anyway.
I just was involved on this one past show. But yeah, we did one night called the Patrick Roscoe night, and it was basically Trampoline Hall is a lecture series that I started in 2001, and people are invited to speak on subjects that they're not experts in. That's sort of the concept, and then the audience asks questions. So there's three lectures a night, and in the first couple of years, we did all sorts of different things in addition to that, and one was a night about Patrick Roscoe. So I got a private detective to follow him and report on him, and we had Patrick meet with a psychoanalyst who then, reported on Patrick's mental state on stage, and I created a panel with, like, an ex-girlfriend, a friend, and a stranger, and we all talked about Patrick, and there was just, like, I had a friend, Chris Turner, who's a journalist, write three obituaries for him. one, and I think that was Chris's idea, because I just asked him to write one obituary, but he had three, like, one if Patrick died famous, one if he died, like, as a nobody, or whatever, and one infamous. I can't remember, and then at the end of the night, Patrick got on, everyone, like, really wanted Patrick to get on stage, and he'd just been sitting there dying throughout the whole show in the front row, like, just completely blushing and everything, and horrified in some way, and then he got on stage, and for some reason, he had, like, a bouquet of flowers in his hand. I can't remember where that came from, but I just remember him standing there with this sort of burn all over his skin, and he said very emotionally, I would never wish anything like this on any of you, but I'm so glad that somebody wished it on me.
Aww.
It was like this Aww. Very... and then everyone like burst into huge applause. It was like a very nice moment. That was a really fun night.
Anybody who was there, of course, now knows plentifully who he is, but I don't. Who is Patrick Roscoe?
He's just a friend of mine that I found kind of intriguing at the time and wanted to embarrass and celebrate.
You know, I've been talking to people about friendship, people who have come to this table. It seems to be one of those things that's coming up. Have you always been somebody who's good with friends? Have you always been surrounded by friends?
No, it's a very new thing in my life, friends. I mean, I had always a couple of friends, you know, except for grade 5 and 6, which is a bad age for any girl, and then in my early 20s, no, not so hot, and then I just, in the last couple of years, I feel like I've developed some really amazing friendships, and it's sort of the best time of my life in terms of that, in terms of having people around me who I really love. And
are you deliberate about the cultivation? Does it simply happen to you? Is it do you think that people just at for whatever reason at a given point in life are attracted to different people?
Yeah, it's a really neat question. How do friendships come about? I think that you probably have to really like people. That is a good start. Mm-hmm. And then I think for a lot of my life I really didn't. And then in addition to liking people, you have to be exposed to a lot of people because some of them you're not obviously going to, you know, have any sort of potential with as a friendship. And then you've got to trust that they like you as well at a certain point, which is really key, I think. But Carl Wilson and I had parties every 2 weeks at our house, every second Wednesday. And we did that for about 2 or 3 years. And it was because we were sort of bored in the city and we didn't feel like we really had anybody that we really particularly liked hanging out with or anything. And my grandmother said, well, what you have to do is invite people to your house, you know? And this was this kind of, this idea that she had, this sort of like, that's what you do in Hungary, or that's what we would have done. And so we started inviting people and we just had these amazing parties. And most of my friends are sort of from that, but then they just genuinely became friends. And most of the people who came to the parties aren't really, I would consider them my friends anymore. They were just people who came to the parties, who I liked at the time a lot. But I don't know. So then somehow the regularity of seeing people is also necessary for friendship, you know?
Yeah, also being able to stay awake, I'm finding. You know, as I get older, I just want to go to bed early and go to sleep. It really gets in the way of friendships.
Yeah. Yeah, it helps if you have nowhere to go in the morning. Definitely. Yeah.
What have you got happening now? What are you working on now that Tickner is making its way through the world?
Well, I've got a lot of projects, but no book. I started to write a book, and I just... I'm a little tired of it in some way. It just doesn't seem like a really interesting thing to do right now is, you know, to write a book, to write a novel or something, to me.
Yeah.
Not saying for the whole world, but it doesn't seem very exciting to do that. It's not as exciting as working, as doing things with other people, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I know I keep using this word fun, but like what the heck is, you know, I think that fun includes rigor. Like, I think fun, it's no fun if you're not trying to do it well. Like, part of fun is trying to do something really, really, really well. But it doesn't really matter what you do. So that's kind of dawning on me as well. Yeah.
Sheila Hetty, H-E-T-I, her website, SheilaHetty.com. She joined the table from our studio in Toronto. A couple of things by way of a P.S. Since we spoke, several weeks back now, her dance collaboration with those performers from the National Ballet has wound up, and she wanted to note as well that another participant at the temperance session was the painter Margot Williamson. Sheila's novel Tickner is published by Anansi. Next week on 10 Times Table, the musicologist Kevin Bazana and New Yorker editor David Remnick.
A great German Yiddish word, Sitzfleisch.
Which
the ability to keep your ass in a chair and make 3,000 phone calls. That, very often, is what reporting is.
Ten Times Table is produced at CBC Vancouver by Rosemary Allenbach and by me, Bill Richardson. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.